Welcome, everyone, to our second session with Professor Leanna Fuller of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. She's talking about engaging difference in congregations. Truly a wonderful pair of seminars, and we thank you so much for coming to share what you know with us. Next, coming up next, during the month of February, we're going to shift our focus to history and learn about Frances Willard and the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Elaine France, professor of history at Kent State University, has been here quite a few times presenting seminars about the KKK, about the Civil War, about police violence in Pittsburgh. And so this is a new one. And I think we've got a lot to learn from Elaine. She always is engaging, and I think this will be very interesting. Frances Willard was quite, as we might say today, a pistol. She was born in Ohio and worked a lot in the middle of the country early in her career, including teaching for a while at a Methodist secondary school in Pittsburgh. But the main thing she's known for is, of course, the temperance movement, which led to prohibition. But way beyond that, she and this Women's Christian Temperance Union fundamentally transforms popular culture, roles of women in public life, our sense of our national purpose, and the relationship of churches to the state. Like, that's a lot. And also, in addition to the temperance, the WCTU was crucial in the success of women's suffrage, the battle against domestic violence, the struggle for labor rights, food reform, pacifism, protecting girls and women from rape, prison reform, and any number of other causes. So I hope this is enough to get you to come back and invite your friends. And now, Professor Fuller.
Morning, everyone. I've been asked to open us with a word of prayer, so if you would please pray with me. Gracious God, we thank you for this day, for this time when we can come into your house and worship you and learn as we grow in faith and discipleship. We thank you, God, for the many gifts we've each been given. We ask, God, that you would show each of us in our own lives ways that we can be a blessing to others to share all that we've received. Be with us now in this hour as we listen for your voice and inspire us to go out and to do your will each day in all that we do. These things we pray in your name. Amen. Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here. I know that not everybody was necessarily here last week. So I thought I would start just by very briefly kind of telling you a little about who I am and then a little about what we did last week and how I see it connecting to what we're going to talk about this week. So as Sarah so graciously said, my name's Leanna Fuller. I teach at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. My area of specialty is pastoral care, but my dissertation research and kind of my active research interests are around conflict in congregations. So thinking about how we engage difference is something that's been important to me for a long time. It actually grows out of my own experience as a pastor. I was a pastor of a church in the United Church of Christ tradition, which is my denomination. And way back in 2005, these many years ago now, we went through a big conflict in the congregation I was serving. It resulted in a lot of people leaving and a lot of really difficult dynamics in the church. And that's kind of what spurred me to go back and think about this in my graduate work and my research. So what we did last week was we were really talking about this idea of how we engage difference in our communities of faith. Because I've spent a lot of years now thinking and writing about this. And I think what really is happening often in conflicts, especially conflicts that we see in churches, is that a difference emerges in the group, which is not that unusual, right? We know intellectually that we're not all the same. But a lot of times those differences don't really feel that threatening. But sometimes a difference emerges in a relationship or in a group, and suddenly it does feel threatening. Suddenly it feels like this difference has a lot more emotional intensity attached to it. Now, that could be for a lot of reasons, and we're going to get into that in just a minute. But what happens often then is coping with that difference becomes very challenging because of the emotional intensity. Last of what we talked about was really about trying to think about ways of engaging difference that might help us not get to that place of emotional intensity as quickly, maybe. So we talked about two major things last week. We talked about the idea of honoring dignity. And I talked a bit about Donna Hicks's book called Dignity. And it's really about trying to see the humanity in another person and do specific things in our interaction with others that preserves dignity. But the other thing we talked about was listening, and about how oftentimes what happens in conflicts is neither party is really listening to the other. What we're actually doing is thinking about what we're going to say in response, or thinking about why the other person is wrong, rather than listening to understand. So those were kind of the two big pieces last week. And from my perspective, those were, I won't say they're completely preventive because conflict's going to happen, but from my perspective, those two things can really help us in relationships create an environment where maybe really destructive conflict doesn't have to happen. This week, we're focused more on, okay, what do we do when a conflict has emerged and it is taking on some of these more difficult dynamics? Because that is going to happen too. No matter how healthy a relationship is, no matter how healthy a group is, there will be conflict eventually. And so when that happens, then how do we deal with it? So I think it's kind of a two-prong approach. One is trying to do things in a way that helps prevent conflict from really emerging in an intense way. But then when it does emerge in an intense way, we can still cope with it in ways that are more helpful rather than harmful. So just a quick kind of survey question for you all. And we won't worry with the mic right now because whatever you say, I'll just repeat. But just off the top of your head, what would you say churches fight about? Doesn't have to be this church, but just any church. What do churches fight about? What do people fight about in church? Yes. Okay. Okay. Maybe just say that again, Dan.
As you know, from what I sent you, I worked in 12 different churches over the years that were in conflict. Every time it was about the pastor.
Yes, about pastoral leadership. That's a big one. Other ideas?
Resources, where limited resources should be allocated, mission versus property versus those types of issues.
Yep, resources, which could be money, but also property, things like that. Yes, Todd.
Tess. I've seen people fuss about worship and hymnals.
Yes. Worship and specifically hymnals. That sounds like there's a story there, but we won't have to share it now. Anybody else got? Yes, another one.
Some key topics, whether it would be gay, you know, lesbians and the acceptance in the church or those types of things right. Can sometimes be dividing.
Yeah. So cultural issues, sexuality, definition of marriage, things like that, for sure.
Looking back in history, there hasn't been so long since people got all fussed about women in leadership. Absolutely. And some churches are still hung up on
it. Right. I was going to say that's not a settled issue in many traditions and denominations. So, yes. And I would maybe expand that even not just about women in ministry, but over time, over history, we can see there's been a lot of arguments about who can be called, who can be authorized to be ordained. Certainly for women, that's been difficult, but also people of color, folks in the LGBTQ community. Those are all groups that have struggled with that. Anything else that comes to your mind?
The process of change itself, it's a big umbrella. We had an interim pastor for some time. Mm-hmm. Who said the smaller the issue, the greater the conflict. And I think that's also true. It does get that way.
That's so true. So change. I like the way you put that. Another way I've heard it put is never is the fighting so fierce when the stakes are so low, right? So fighting over the hymnals or the color of the carpet. So this is really good segue, this idea of change, because you all have named a lot of great ideas about things churches fight about. I would say a lot of those things probably have to do with change at their root. Research shows that the three biggest things that churches get into conflict about, you all named them all already, pastoral leadership, money, and worship. Those are really the top three. There are lots of others that we could also think about, some of which you've named. So we've named a lot of different things here. You could probably think of more. But one takeaway from this that I began thinking about early in my study of conflict is that often it seems the content of the conflict or the thing that the conflict is sort of about, theoretically, is often not the real issue. So it's not to say that people don't actually care about those things. They do. But I think the real issue often is the emotional intensity that comes with the conflict. Or another way to think about it is the emotional intensity that gets attached to the issue that sometimes to us maybe in the moment feels out of proportion. Like, why is somebody losing their mind over whether to use frosted or clear light bulbs in the sanctuary? Now, you all think that's a hypothetical example. It is not. Okay, so what could that be about, right? Because surely it can't be just about the difference of light bulbs. Yes, we have a comment here. Ted's bringing the microphone for you.
Well, that tension was there before the light bulb issue ever came up.
Sure.
Yep. The light bulb is just a catalyst to unleash those ill feelings that have probably been there a long time.
Absolutely. So many times what I've discovered is that what it's about is not really what it's about, right? That there's usually a complex mix of other things that sort of get funneled up into this particular argument or disagreement. So as to use another example, and I write about this in my book, the church that I served, the big fight we had was over sexuality. It was over our denomination's choice to support equal marriage. And again, I would never say that people on both sides of that argument didn't truly have strong feelings on both sides. They did. But what I discovered in thinking about that conflict more deeply was there were a lot of other things going on, right? So some of the people who were most vocal actually had longstanding tension with the senior pastor, for example. So all of that was playing into the way this conflict developed. And it is that emotional intensity piece that I mentioned a couple minutes ago that comes into conflict sometimes that can really get in the way of healthy functioning. So from my perspective, it's not that conflict itself is a problem. That is actually just a very normal part of living in human relationship and community. We're all different. We're going to have disagreements. We're not always going to be the same. That's normal. But how we engage that can be life-giving or it can be death-dealing. So I'm going to put a couple questions up on the screen here. Let's see. Maybe I didn't turn it on. Oh, no, there it is. Okay. So, and I'll ask you to think about these questions just for a couple of minutes, and then we'll get some responses from you all. But what do you experience? So thinking about actually you as an individual, when a group that you're in gets caught up in an argument. So you can think about, like, how does this feel emotionally? How does it feel in your body? And then secondly, what would you say the group experiences? So the first one is more your individual self, and then what is the group experience? I'll give you just a minute to kind of think about that. Anybody have thoughts? Yes, Dan.
Well, on the first one, you could choose to stay on the sidelines and just withdraw, mm-hmm. maybe still show up, but just be silent, or decide to get in the center and be part of the friction.
Okay. Anybody else have a thought about what you personally experience when the group gets into an argument? Yeah, discomfort. Discomfort. Yep, absolutely. I think a lot of people would agree with that. Most people don't really enjoy being in the midst of a conflict. There are a few people I've met who do. You know, you wonder a little bit about those folks, but yeah, discomfort is a big one. Any others?
I think the tension that arises mm-hmm. when a disagreement occurs brings two issues at the same time. One, the content of the argument. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the relationship between the two parties who are in disagreement, or maybe it's more than two.
Yeah.
But you have the relationship coming into play here, and whether or not it will suffer as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. So sometimes it's the relationship that may actually help keep the argument from getting out of hand, because sometimes people do pause and think to themselves, I don't want to say something I'm going to regret. Sometimes they don't. And then there's relational damage to cope with, as well as whatever the disagreement is about. Yes, sir.
Sometimes if there's an argument, we react and say, well, somebody's got to be right, somebody's got to be wrong. And we never think that both may be right.
Right.
And that their argument may be misplaced. And the issue that that is being argued about is sort of a camouflage for something else. So it's not as simple as right or wrong. He's wrong. But there's respect to listen to what is being said by the side that you disagree with. And you might find that you don't totally disagree. It's not so simple as right or wrong.
I think that's true. And even when there is sort of a decision to be made and there's sort of one side or the other, there's usually a lot more nuance and complexity, right, than we often see at the beginning. And there may be a lot more overlap or a lot more similarity. And the disagreements may be about particular things, but finding that common ground sometimes can be helpful. Yes, Ted.
On the group experience, something that is, I think, quite common and common is fragmentation. You know, in classic for a church, you have a big fuss about something and then half the church leaves and the rest of the church stays and moves on.
Right. Yeah, that's very true. So one thing that does happen, what is the group experience? Sometimes it's fragmentation, polarization, the group getting split into smaller subgroups. That frequently happens. Anybody else have a thought about what the group experiences when there's a disagreement?
Sometimes both persons, one person is particularly
outspoken on a subject and sort of look for leadership in that sense, someone who steps up.
Yes, absolutely. So there's actually a name for that in social psychology. It's the exemplar. So it's, you know, whoever becomes kind of the person who's seen as the representative of a particular position. And you see that emerge very strongly when there is that fragmentation or polarization. Another thing that sometimes happens in groups is a little bit different than the polarization, although I think the impulse is from the same place, which is a strong pull for everybody to agree, right? So sometimes you see the disagreement and immediately the groups separate. Sometimes you see a real strong pull toward the center. And the problem there is that then it's hard for people to disagree. So then it's like people are sort of restrained a little bit from speaking their opinion because there's a very strong pull towards sameness. And sometimes those two things happen at the same time, right? Yes, Dan.
Of course, the problem with that is you didn't make it go away. You just covered it up.
That's right.
And it will still be there for the next.
Absolutely. Spark. Absolutely. So that's very true. So even when a group can be convinced to kind of all get on the same page, if that unity is not real, if people are actually suppressing their thoughts and feelings and just sort of doing it to please the group, there will be consequences later. It may work in the short term, but long term, it will be hard. So I want to, now that we've kind of talked a little bit about, you know, what do you feel as an individual when a group gets caught up in an argument? What is the group experience? I want to go back to this idea of emotional intensity that I was mentioning a few minutes ago. And the way that I tend to talk about that is by using the term anxiety. I'm going to move to the next slide now. There we go. So anxiety, I'm using this, we hear this term used a lot in our culture in a lot of different ways. It can mean a specific mental health disorder. It can mean just a general sense of malaise. The way I'm using it here is more the technical definition from family systems theory, which I'll say more about in a minute. But really the simplest definition in the way that I'm using the word is the sense of threat that people or systems experience. And I think that what is often happening in conflict, this tension, people have used the word tension, discomfort, that feeling that you all have named a few times today is what I would call anxiety. And it's just that basic sense of threat. Now, when I say threat, you know, obviously we don't think that people in our church necessarily are going to physically attack us. Yet, when people are arguing very vociferously in a way that directly opposes something that I value and believe, I can experience that as an emotional or a psychological threat. And as we were talking about last week, what happens in the body when you have emotional or psychological threat is the same thing that happens when you have a physical threat. The same chemicals are released. It creates the same fight or flight reactions. So in my work, I use family systems theory as a tool to help me better understand how this process of emotional intensity or anxiety works in groups. And I just want to see this. I know probably a couple of you do. How many people have heard of family systems theory or know something about it? So a few folks here. Okay. So I'll just say just a little bit about it, and I'm happy to say more later if there are questions. Family systems theory is really just a psychological theory. It was originally developed to think about biological families, as the name implies, but it's used now as a way of looking at human systems, whether that is an actual extended family, whether it's an organization, a congregation, any sort of large group of people where there are multiple relationships involved. And the thing about systems theory that I would just share that may be different from other psychological theories that you might have encountered or know about is that that word systems is really important. Family systems theory tries to look at the big picture of what is happening in a group, as opposed to seeing problems, what we would call problems, as sort of individualized. So an individual way of thinking about a problem is, oh, that person's making a choice, or that person has a disorder. Those things may still be true, okay? People are still making choices, they may have a disorder, but that cannot usually fully explain all of what is happening in a system at any given time. An example would be, let's say you know of a child who is doing well in school and suddenly starts failing. An individualized way of thinking about that would be, well, the child just decided to stop doing his homework or doesn't pay attention in class. But if I were to tell you this child's parents are in the midst of a divorce, you would suddenly see that behavior in a very different light. You would see that behavior as a response to what is happening in the larger system. So that's what family systems theory tries to do. It tries to look at what all is happening in the system and how does that help us understand what's going on. So that feeling of dis-ease or discomfort, tension that we were talking about earlier that tends to arise in us or in the group. Family systems theory talks about that as anxiety. It's that sense of threat that people or systems experience. Another way to think about it is how safe do I feel versus how threatened do I feel? We can probably all right now in our minds think of groups of people where when we walk in to that group, we feel very safe. We can probably also think of groups of people or environments. When we walk in, we do not feel safe. We feel tense. We feel like we're walking on eggshells. We feel like something could happen at any moment. You can usually sense it, right, in yourself, in your spirit. That's the difference between an environment that feels safe to somebody and an environment that doesn't. But anxiety, as I put up here on the slide, is not quite the same thing as fear, because fear is a reaction to the known. So we know what we're afraid of. If I'm being chased by a bear, That's fear, because I know what's chasing me. But fear is actually a really important emotion for us, because it helps tap into some biological hardwiring in our bodies, right? If I see a threat and I'm afraid, it initiates a response in my nervous system that helps me decide whether I should hide or run or try to fight, right? So it's got an important role to play. But anxiety is different from fear, because with anxiety, we don't know exactly what it is we're afraid of. You know, people, again, have used these words, tension, discomfort. It's like a sense of feeling not at ease, but not necessarily knowing exactly why. And so that's why fear is actually in some ways a little bit easier to control or easier to cope with, because we know what we're afraid of. We can maybe take some steps to alleviate it. But with anxiety, we don't know what we're afraid of. We can't put our finger on it. And it's just not as tangible. So we can't control it as easily. We can't deal with it as easily. So another thing about anxiety is that it can be acute or chronic within the theory that they make this distinction. So acute anxiety is what happens when there's a crisis, right? Or something really bad happens. Let's say a family loses their house in a fire. Obviously, that is going to create a lot of acute anxiety for everybody who's involved with that situation. But that's not necessarily unusual or abnormal. Everybody would feel anxiety in that situation. However, with acute anxiety, once the immediate crisis is passed and people start to be able to kind of cope with it and figure out what to do, that anxiety dissipates. Chronic anxiety, as the name suggests, is anxiety that's just kind of always there. It's always permeating the environment. It's always making people feel uncomfortable. But again, people don't know exactly why. So again, I think you could probably all think of organizations, groups, even perhaps parts of families, that there is a feeling of chronic anxiety, that whenever you're participating in that group or that set of relationships, there's a sense that, oh, something could set this off at any minute. We're walking on eggshells. We're being very careful what we say. There's just a sense of not feeling fully safe. Yes, I think we have a comment down here, Ted, if you wouldn't mind bringing the microphone.
I used to be a social worker, and the systems theory, the way it worked, somebody would bring a child to a psychiatrist, and the kid was really anxious and upset. And what happened was, it was the system. It was parental conflict, and they triangulated the child, projected their conflict onto the child. But so if the treatment person got the parents into counseling, all of a sudden the child became.
Exactly.
So the way this works in churches, there can be a member and there's conflict in the church, and the member solves it by leaving.
Sure.
But if it was a healthy system, whatever that person who was a member who was thinking of leaving was experiencing, it could be because of a church conflict that needs to be resolved, but it won't be because the person leaves.
Right. Yeah. So you can see how easily the more people you add into a system, the more complicated the situation becomes and the more tricky it is to untangle what all's going on. Because in a church, for example, the church itself is a system, right? We all have relationships inside the congregation, but we also all bring our families of origin and the dynamics we learned growing up into that system. So we all bring the ways we've been shaped and formed into that system, and it becomes very complicated very quickly. So as you're saying, the person who's experiencing anxiety because of a conflict and chooses to leave, that person leaving also causes anxiety for other people, because they say, look, people are leaving the church now over this. It just becomes like a snowball, right? So this idea of chronic anxiety is one where, you know, chronic anxiety is usually indicative of a system that is not as healthy, as you were saying, where people are not as able to deal with their differences constructively, where communication is typically not as transparent or direct. And it just creates a lot of just unhealthy dynamics, and it creates that sense of chronic anxiety, which eventually takes a toll on everybody, sometimes even without being conscious of it. The other thing about anxiety is that it is infectious. It can be like a chain reaction. So you may have seen this yourself in a group. one person gets very worked up about something, suddenly a lot of people are worked up about it who weren't necessarily before. It kind of spreads. And that's one thing that's very difficult about anxiety, because it can be sort of difficult to control. It's almost like a wildfire. And it can be hard then to sort of rein it back in once that gets going. But the thing about anxiety too that's very complicated is that the anxiety itself is, you know, a reaction to a threat, right? But then the anxiety becomes itself a threat. So, you know, our church is worried about XYZ issue. People get anxious. Well, then people say the church is anxious. Now that's another sense of threat. Oh, the church is going to split apart. That's a sense of threat. So the anxiety builds upon itself. And you can see how easily it could do that. And how well or poorly a system functions has a lot to do with how the system handles anxiety. So some systems actually are pretty healthy and they can handle anxiety pretty well. It doesn't mean there won't be bumps in the road, but they won't necessarily feel like they have to split apart over every disagreement. Others, it feels very fragile, you know, that like any moment somebody could express a different opinion and it could just set everybody off. So what happens when a group is more anxious? This is how you know you may be in a group where there's a higher level of anxiety. When the level of anxiety or emotional intensity is high, conflicts are instinctively seen in very binary terms. So good or bad, right or wrong, what you were saying before, faithful or unfaithful, us versus them. In psychological terms, we would call this splitting, where you know there's just sort of two options and nothing in between. The problem is, especially in churches, is that when conflict is framed this way, there's really only three options of what can happen. Your group, whichever one you sort of associate with, can win. Your group can lose. Or we can keep the feud going indefinitely. And the problem is, no matter which of these three things happens, the whole group loses, because it creates a lot of fragmentation and polarization, like we were talking about earlier. Now, to sort of understand why this happens, because of course, all the time people are asking me, why do churches do this? Why do people do this? You know, why can't we focus on our commonalities? Why can't we work together to solve problems? Well, part of the problem is because we have a lot of hardwiring in us psychologically. We talked a little bit about this last week. Human beings are just, we just like being with people who seem like us. I mean, just kind of at a basic level. It's something we kind of have to work to overcome. So in terms of group concepts, what happens is most groups form around a shared concern or need. Okay, so not thinking about families because you're born into those, but any other group that you're a part of, generally you have some kind of similarity with them. You know, people choose a church, I think, often because they experience something there that attracts them, that feels comfortable, right? So already the similarity is what people kind of think is binding them together. The implicit assumption is that we all share that concern or need, or at least that we share an interpretation of it. So we are all Christian. We've all joined this church. We're all Presbyterian. The thing is, those are big categories. They can mean a lot of things, but people don't often think about that when they're joining. We can usually accept or ignore differences to a point, right? Certain kinds of differences is not a big deal. You know, whether you like, you know, chocolate or vanilla ice cream, doesn't matter. Those differences don't threaten us. They can be usually be managed, but when they can't be managed, as we were just talking about, they tend to trigger anxiety. Then when the differences start to generate anxiety, you get to number four, the awareness of differences generates subgroups, especially in an anxious system. So it may be that you can go along for a long time with the differences being okay, but then a certain difference arises. Maybe it's over politics. Maybe it's over a particular understanding of the faith. Maybe it's a stand on a cultural issue of some kind. But suddenly this difference emerges that feels more important and therefore more threatening if not everybody in the group is on board. And in an anxious system, this happens more. And it happens more intensely. The differences that seem to involve incompatible agendas result in a move towards splitting. So what you get is when the difference becomes too important or too high stakes, the groups form. And if there's not a good way of dealing with that, eventually the groups will start to move apart from each other. And that's where you get potential splitting. So an example of a significant difference becoming manifest while the group is together would be, let's say, a Sunday school class, a committee meeting, somebody raises an opinion, somebody else raises a really different opinion, and suddenly there's tension, right, about something that feels important. That's when the group is together. But significant differences can also arise when the group is scattered. So the phone tree after church, the parking lot meetings after church. No one knows what I'm talking about, I'm sure. But where, you know, there's a difference, but it's not dealt with directly in the group. But when the group scatters, then people are calling each other. People are finding each other in the parking lot. Did you hear what so-and-so said? Right. So that's an example of the differences arising when the group is scattered, which sometimes is even worse because then there's not an opportunity to deal with it. So the progression of conflict and splitting tends to look like this. The different surfaces, this part's inevitable. Every group's going to have differences surface. We're humans. We're different from each other. That's normal. Subgrouping occurs. That part is also inevitable. Larger groups are always going to break down into smaller groups. That's probably always going to happen. But they don't necessarily have to be at odds with each other, right? But people are going to sort themselves into some smaller groups usually. Arguments are going to break out. This is a likely occurrence with subgroups. Now, this part is where it really starts to turn into a destructive dynamic. Power struggle increases in intensity. Because it's one thing to have different groups that have sort of different viewpoints or different agendas, but eventually somebody's going to want their agenda to be the one that is adopted by the full group, right? And when that happens, that's when you start to see a power struggle. And then when you get to splitting, we're in dangerous territory because it's hard to come back from splitting. So the church I mentioned that I served, a bunch of people left. There was very little chance that those people were going to come back. Once we got to that point, because the emotional intensity was so high, a lot of people had said things that couldn't be taken back. It was going to be real hard to undo that splitting process. So my goal as an educator and a researcher and somebody who talks to churches is to try to help congregations not get to that point. But here's how you know if you're starting to move towards splitting. An increase in personalizing the issue. So a particular person or group is the problem. You know, if so-and-so would just leave, everything would be fine. Well, family systems theory tells us that is not true. Because whatever that person is doing, someone else would probably do it if that person leaves. Because they're playing a role in the system, right? They're maintaining the system in a particular type of way. Now, that's not to say that a person might be doing some things that are really inappropriate or unacceptable to the group. So two things can be true, right? It could be true that, hey, this person, they need to change their behavior because what they're doing is not helpful. But it probably is not true that that person leaving would suddenly magically solve all of the group's problems. That's almost never true. In fact, Dan, I appreciate what you said about the churches all being in conflict over their pastor. Unfortunately, congregations have a tendency to do this exact thing, but the person they think will solve their problems with leaving is the pastor. And that's almost never true. You know, the easiest to blame. And now granted, if the pastor's doing something egregiously wrong, you know, embezzling money or something, sure, that's probably what needs to happen. But I've almost never seen a church that got healthier by firing their pastor. Almost never. It's more of an example of this, which is we personalize the issue, we make it their fault. And if we just get rid of them and get a new person, it'll be solved. But it almost never happens like that. Vague assertions, they always, you never. So speaking in generalizations, a strong desire to diagnose the other side, to explain their closed-mindedness. I'm sure none of us have ever felt this way about anything. Accumulation of anecdotal evidence of the other side's dishonesty or sneakiness. So we cherry pick the examples that show the thing that we want to say about that group. And then finally, fostering outrage on wrongs inflicted on your side but downplaying the wrongs that your side has inflicted. And truthfully, in most conflicts, both sides are doing some of this stuff, right? Yes, Dan.
Of course, you just described today's politics.
Yes, absolutely.
Saying that goes on in church.
Yes, this is where we are as a culture and in many of our churches, unfortunately. Yes, Dan.
And speaking of that, there was a real interesting piece in the Washington Post last week about affective polarization being what's driving our politics and driving a lot of this hostility, which is basically an academic term to say we're not really disagreeing on facts. We're getting polarized because we're deciding we hate people who think about things differently than we do.
Yep, that's very true. Yeah, and it becomes more about identity, right, than actually thinking about an issue and choosing a position. So this might be kind of depressing, like seeing all this, like, wow, what do we do? Yeah, good news. Well, here's the thing. I do think there are things that people in congregations, leaders especially, can do to, I'm not saying in every situation they could prevent this, but I think there are a lot of things that we could do to perhaps mitigate it or make it a little better. So the key to not getting to this point here, from my perspective, is helping to keep the system anxiety low or as low as possible so that people can operate from a calmer, less reactive place. I mean, as I was saying, you know, in the church that I served, the emotional intensity went from zero to, you know, like 99 almost overnight. And so there was very little opportunity for anybody to sit with what we were talking about, to really reflect on what we were doing. It was very, very reactive. It was very emotional. And by that, I don't mean talking about feelings. I mean, sort of the automatic way we respond when we feel threatened. So sort of a knee-jerk reaction, I guess is how I would describe it. So if we could find a way to, like, another metaphor is turn down the temperature, you know, to notice when the temperature is getting a little too high and turn it down, where people could then talk in ways that would be more constructive. Again, I'm not saying we would get rid of conflict or we would avoid every kind of major disagreement. But I do think we might be able to make it better. But this requires, I think, a few different things. It requires clear and direct communication. And from leaders especially, it requires a willingness to take a position while still staying in touch. Now, this is, again, a family systems idea. Family systems calls it differentiation. And what it basically means is, as a leader, I'm able to clearly say what my position is, but that's without saying you have to think that's what your position must be. And it's while also saying I truly desire to be in relationship with you and to understand your position if it differs from mine. It's actually a really hard place to be and to maintain when emotional intensity is high. So in the example of my own church, there were people that were really, really mad at me and the senior pastor because we did not agree with the idea of taking the church out of the denomination. We couldn't. That was, you know, our denomination. So there were people who just simply stopped talking to us. Now, to be honest, that was a little bit more comfortable for me not to have to talk to those people. But probably a healthier, more constructive way would have been for me to try to keep a relationship with those folks. Now, I don't know if it would have worked, but at the time, I was so anxious about what was going on, I didn't feel I could do it. So I just was like, fine, they don't want to talk to me, I won't talk to them. But if I could have been in a less anxious place, I might have been able to find a way to approach some of those folks and say, could we have conversation about what's going on? And again, who knows? You don't always, you know, get to the solution you want. But yes, Dan.
Yeah, in this church, our pastor dealt with the gay marriage question mm-hmm. by having a series of five congregational meetings where they were mostly him listening. I mean, he laid out his right. views from the Bible, but it was a lot of listening, and to a large degree, at least in my opinion, defused this mm-hmm. before the issue was called.
Right.
So it was proactive right. way before the issue
yes.
was called.
Yes. Yes, being proactive is a huge thing that leaders and anybody can do, really, is to trying to engage an issue before it takes on this big emotional intensity, which, you know, most of us don't do that, right? We say, oh, there's an issue coming. It's going to be divisive. It's going to be controversial. Let's not talk about it. But the problem is eventually it comes into the group and there's nothing you can do at that point except let it emerge. And then sometimes everybody's very reactive at that point.
Of course, the problem is most people in congregations do not understand these topics you're describing. Mm. Therefore, they're a victim of the family system.
Absolutely. So this is a great segue into thinking about what could help in these situations. Now, when I want to just sort of foreground this by saying, when I say leader in this rest of our time together today, I don't just mean the pastor or people that have an official role. They sit on session or what have you. Family systems theory actually says that anyone in a group who can bring a greater sense of calm, a greater sense of personal safety, and less reactivity, that person is a leader in the group. I bet you can all sit here right now and think of someone that you know that when they come into the room, doesn't matter what their official position is, when they come into a room, everybody goes, oh, okay, good. So-and-so's here. You know, like somebody that brings that sense of calming presence with them. That's a leader. It doesn't matter if they have a title or not. So what I think groups, congregations especially need is leaders, but I think this applies especially to leaders with specific offices, who recognize their own position in the conflict. So a pastor who knows that the conflict is about them, they can't deal with that conflict in the same way as if it were a conflict about something else. They're probably going to need somebody to help them because immediately you're seen as having, you know, too much of a stake. The emotional intensity of the conflict. So how hot is it? How high is the temperature? The need for a planned process, deliberate steps that take time. So Dan, you were mentioning a series of meetings that was planned in advance. I mean, the rule of thumb is the bigger the issue, the more important it is, the bigger the decision, the more time it will take. And the thing is, in groups, and I'm not just saying churches here, I've seen it in organizations, places I've worked, people are not that patient for this thing, type of thing. They want to make a decision quickly, often, because in their mind, making a decision will get rid of the anxiety because we've settled the issue. We made a decision. No, actually, if it's not done well, it creates more anxiety. That's what happened in my church. We want to have a vote on whether to leave the denomination. Let's have it in 2 months. It's not enough time. But that's what we did. And then a bunch of people left because there wasn't enough time to actually have the conversations. Another really important thing is ground rules or guidelines for the work that has to be done. Part of what I witnessed in my own church was a lot of really unhelpful behavior that got us nowhere in terms of actually trying to figure out what was going on. It just made people more upset and it just damaged relationships. And this, you know, it speaks to how the senior pastor and I both felt completely ill-prepared for this situation, because we didn't think to start by saying, here's the ground rules. Because, you know, I wouldn't have thought that a man my grandfather's age would stand up and scream at other people in church, you know, but that's what happened. So really, really important to have ground rules, especially the more emotionally intense the issue is, and the key role of a referee or a facilitator. Now, sometimes that can be the official leader of the group, could be the pastor. Sometimes if the emotional intensity is too high, maybe it can't be. Maybe it needs to be an outside person, somebody from the presbytery, a consultant, what have you. It just, a lot depends on these different dynamics. But this is what we have to know about and kind of work with, I think, to start setting the stage for something that could be more constructive and less, you know, less tearing apart a group. So what can we do to help lower the emotional intensity of conflict? The theory, family systems theory, says that leaders in a group and how they respond to anxiety within the system has a disproportionate effect on the group in both directions. So if the leader is able to stay less anxious, be more calm, more transparent, that has a big effect on the group. But if the leader is highly anxious and highly reactive, that has a huge effect on the group too. So the first thing is, you know, every one of us, whatever our position in the group, we start with ourselves. We work on ourselves. But another, here's another list of things that I think leaders can do. I'm just going to say each one, and then I'll say a little bit more about each. So acknowledge difference and anxiety. So this whole series we've been working on together is about trying to engage difference. One of the things I saw in my church was that people were simply not aware of the differences that existed between them, which is really weird to say because some of them have been going to church together for decades, but they just sort of ignored the things that they knew were different, that were troubling to them, and they focused on the things that they had in common. And that's a very normal thing. We all do that. But the problem is, you know, when we got into this really intense conflict, I had a woman say to me, you know, I've been going to church with her for 30 years and I never knew she thought that. And I thought, well, that's a little bit sad that you've been going to church with her for 30 years and you never really knew her. You thought you did. You assumed a lot, but it wasn't actually true. So if we can find ways to surface the differences in ways that are maybe less threatening at a time when we're not embroiled in a conflict, when we're not trying to make a big decision. So, hey, let's have a conversation about, you know, each of us and how we were, you know, what tradition we were raised in and what we were raised to think about the faith, or let's have a conversation about how we feel about different issues. That could actually help surface the differences at a time when they don't feel so important, right? The second thing is to cultivate calm and connected leadership. And I'll say more about that in a second. And then finally, to provide opportunities for all voices to be heard. So I want to say a little bit more about that second one, calm, connected leadership. What is it? Well, as I was saying before, people who can bring a higher level of personal safety, lower level of anxiety, while remaining connected to others, which is a really important part of this, become leaders in the church, and they can have a really important influence on how the group copes with anxiety. The job of leadership, I would say, is to help keep down the level of anxiety in the emotional system of the congregation. But how do we do this? Well, we start with managing our own anxiety. And this, I will say, is a personal task, and it's never finished. It's not like you just master it, you know, overnight sometime. It's a lifelong maturation process. But we manage our own anxiety. We stay connected and in meaningful contact with other people. We don't tell people to be calm. It doesn't work. That's right. It usually has the opposite effect. Instead, we bring our own calmness to the situation. So again, think of the person you know, hopefully you know at least one person like this, who brings a calming presence. That's the goal. It's like that when we come into a situation, we can be the person that helps lower the temperature, that can stay focused on what we're doing and not devolve into sort of, you know, really reactive behaviors. The last thing I mentioned was, let me not go to this one yet. On the previous slide was providing opportunities for everyone to be heard. So you mentioned the idea, Dan, of congregational meetings. I do think that, you know, a series of meetings or conversations can be really helpful ways, especially if there's a decision to be made. I also have come to believe that small group process is usually what's required for people to really feel like their voice has been heard. Because what happened in our church, we had some congregational meetings too. And here's what happened. It was a big group of people. The people who felt the strongest spoke, sometimes very vociferously. And it was kind of like just lobbing, you know, verbal hand grenades back and forth. And there was a huge swath of people in the middle who never said a word. I wonder why. Because they didn't want to be attacked. So there was a couple problems there. One is we didn't set the ground rules properly. But two, we did not create an environment where people could actually listen and feel that they would be heard and not rebutted, attacked, told they were wrong. So in a lot of situations, having a small group process where everybody can feel free to speak and there's a facilitator who can help manage the conversation, sometimes that's the best way. I mean, even in my classroom, I know there are students who are never going to speak if the group is more than eight people. They're just not going to do it because they just don't feel comfortable. So I do a lot of you know, pairs and small groups, because that's when they're going to feel more comfortable. Yes, in the back.
We Presbyterians give the leaders, the session, the responsibility for making decisions.
Yes.
We're not Congregationalists,
right?
In which we have every possible decision,
sure,
the congregation involved. So when you had this, so how do you know what things you need to draw the congregation into?
That's a really good question. And I'm sure it depends a lot on the context and knowing your community and knowing what things are going to get people activated. But I would say, you know, again, a general rule of thumb is the more important the issue, the more, if it's controversial, if you know that there's a lot of disagreement in the body about it, if it involves a big decision, you know, that really kind of affects the whole group in an important way, those are times. Now, again, I know your polity is different, so it's not that necessarily the whole group would vote on it, but those are times, if I were a leader on session, I would say, let's do a small group process where we can hear from a lot of people, whether through actually listening in the small groups themselves or having people take some notes from their different groups, where we can really get a read on how people are feeling about this. Because I know just from being in church leadership, that sometimes the group that's on the leadership council or the session may or may not represent the full spectrum of ideas in the congregation. And that's not a criticism. It's just what happens sometimes. So for me, it would depend a lot on what is seen as the kind of emotional intensity or the importance of the decision. Again, you know, you might make a mistake. Like sometimes you might think, oh, this isn't that important. And you find out really quickly, oh, we should have consulted everybody. But I think that's just a general rule of thumb. I'm not sure there's an answer, you know, one way or the other every time. Yes.
I think there's something very ironic that often the conflicts have very little to do with religion. And right. One great example is the Reformation. When we didn't quiet quit, we left the Catholic Church because right. of the top down, and we weren't being listened to. And that's probably an example of everything you've said.
Yeah.
The best example I can think of is the Reformation.
Yeah.
When our verses weren't heard, we had to not quiet quit, but actually leave.
Yep.
And if things had been managed the way you're recommending that they do, we would all be one Christian body.
Maybe so. I don't know. But a couple of things I will say about, you know, allowing everybody to be heard. There's two kind of important caveats there. One is when I say allow everybody to be heard, I do not mean let people bully or verbally abuse each other. I feel very strongly about this. People in my congregation, as I say, there were some behaviors I was shocked to see in church. And I think people had this feeling that like, well, this is my family. I should be able to just, you know, really show my emotions however I want. Well, here's the thing. We're all part of families. I wouldn't accept that behavior from my 13-year-old. So why would I expect it of a grown man? Or accepted from a grown man, I wouldn't. But in church, I think we have a real tendency to not want to put limits on each other's behavior because like somehow we think that's rude. But to me, it's ruder to let somebody verbally beat up on somebody else in the name of expressing their opinion. The other thing I would say is sometimes people will say, well, you're not hearing me, you're not hearing me. Well, there is a difference actually between being heard and getting your way. They're not the same. And helping people really feel that they're heard and taken seriously is super important. But that does not mean promising everybody's going to get their way because it's not possible, right? But we actually know, even from social science research in areas like law, that when people, for example, who've been convicted of a crime, if they have an opportunity to speak and sort of tell their side, they're much more willing to accept whatever sentence they're given and to feel like they can live with it than if they didn't get that chance. And similarly, at least in my own research, I've found that when people feel I had a chance to name my concerns very clearly, I could tell that I was heard and taken seriously, they're much more willing to support the decision of the group, even if it's not what they wanted. Now, there's still always going to be a few people who will not quite quit, who will leave because they are upset with the decision. That may always happen. But you may have a lot fewer who do that if there's an opportunity for them to speak. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned a few slides ago about the power struggle. Do you have any advice about when the power struggle focuses on money? We all know who our big contributors are.
Right, right.
Not everybody, but so, and that inevitably they have more power.
That's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a great answer to it. I will say, when I was on pastoral staff, I didn't know, and I chose not to know who gave what, because I felt like it might influence my treatment of them or my feelings about whether they were trying to use that as leverage, right? I think the thing about that that's hard is if somebody is actually saying, well, if you don't do what I want, I'm going to withdraw. I mean, that's basically a threat. And it's really hard to have a good, healthy relationship if one party is willing to make a threat. And so, like, I mean, it's easy for me to say because I'm not in this position, right? But if I were the leader in that situation, I feel like I would have to probably say, you need to follow your conscience. Like, if this is what the group has decided and it's not what you wanted, I have to abide by that. Let the chips fall where they may. Now, it's easy to say because I'm not the one that has to worry about the budget. But sometimes those tactics are really being used in a manipulative way. And when people see that they aren't going to get their way, they magically find ways to deal with it. In my own experience, when I've sometimes been willing to just set a real clear boundary, I find that sometimes people's behavior changes pretty radically because they find out, oh, that's not going to work. It's not going to work anymore for me to threaten to pull my money out. So we're at the end of our time. I'll just name three quick techniques that I think can be useful. The anybody else technique is actually really good, not necessarily for decision-making, but for getting a lot of ideas on the table. Most often in a group, when somebody names an idea, everybody immediately wants to like say whether that idea is good or bad. And if a lot of people think the idea is good, other people are less likely to say their idea because they think, oh, the group's already wants this. So anybody else is just a way of saying anybody is a name an idea. We don't discuss it. Anybody else, anybody else, anybody else, anybody else. So we get a lot of ideas on the table and then we can discuss the merits. But there's a social dynamic that happens when we immediately want to try to say whether something's good or bad. Behavioral covenants on your handout that I provided for you. There's an example of a behavioral covenant. This is just a document that a group can create to decide ahead of time, how are we going to behave with each other? I think it's great for groups to do this before they get embroiled in a conflict. Like, let's just set the standards for how we're going to relate to each other. And then functional subgrouping is a strategy where you take people who already agree with each other, put them in a group in the middle, and they talk to each other about why they believe strongly about what they do. And the people who have a different view sit on the outside and listen. They're not allowed to interrupt, not allowed to argue. All they can do is listen. At the end, they can ask questions of clarification only, and then the groups switch. You would be amazed how much more understanding people get when they have to listen first and don't get to argue, rebut, or say you're wrong. That's usually what goes awry in a lot of our so-called conversations. So that's just a little strategy that I've learned about. Thank you all for your attention, your participation. It was great to be with you again.